Okay, so we're going to look into the same cross sections as most of the speakers yesterday have looked in, but now from the point of view, how well do we understand them from the theory side and what remains to be done? Well, to start with, let me first start with a disclaimer. QCD is well established as the theory of strong interactions, and we do no longer need to test QCD. Not needing to test QCD does not mean that we should no longer look into QCD. What is established about QCD is the gauge structure, is the Lagrangian, but what on a process-by-process basis we still have to check is whether we're using QCD in an adequate way, whether we are doing the right expansions, whether we are grouping the right terms together to make sensible predictions for experimental observables, and whether we have also the errors of some approximations which we're doing under good control. So QCD today, talking already about errors, is becoming precision physics. And in particular, if we think back to the LEP era, LEP has provided us with an enormous amount of insight about the electroweak interaction through electroweak precision physics. We could test the electroweak interaction at the loop level. Loop corrections were important to interpret the LEP data. Now, if we want to get to the same level of understanding our theory at the Tevatron or the LHC, even if we look at things like electroweak processes at final states only involving electroweak objects, we are still into having to deal with QCD because our initial state will always be strongly interacting particles. So if we want to do any sort of precision physics at the Tevatron or the LHC, we're into QCD processes. So what does precision physics with QCD mean? Precision physics with QCD, first of all, means a very precise determination of the strong coupling constant, the quark masses, also of electroweak parameters and auxiliary quantities like pattern distributions or the LHC luminosity. Now, all this is not just for the fun of having very precise extraction of QCD parameters, but it serves towards another goal, which is doing precise predictions for new physics effects and their backgrounds. So, as Ian already pointed out, we might not need precision. We might not need very high precision to make a discovery of, say, a new gauge boson or some other new physics object. But after having made a discovery, the discovery will first present itself in terms of an anomaly. And as soon as we start looking into this discovery in more detail and start asking, well, what is it actually what we're seeing here as an anomaly, we are into a more precise understanding of new physics effects and their backgrounds. So we do need to understand all what we believe to know, which is QCD, which is the standard model, to a very high level of accuracy. So what are the theoretical challenges in doing precision QCD? Well, first and foremost, there's a very strong mismatch, which has already been emphasized by yesterday's speakers, between the way theorists see QCD and the way experimentalists see QCD processes. And this mismatch is on the level of the degrees of freedom. QCD describes quarks and gluons, whereas experimenters in their detectors only observe hadrons. So the challenge is to either to describe a pattern to hadron transition such that theory can really make predictions on the hadron level through a description of the pattern to hadron fragmentation process, or to define appropriate final states which are sufficiently inclusive such that it does no longer matter whether you're talking about hadrons and partons, but you're just talking about certain event characteristics like energy flow, energy deposit in certain regions of your detector. And it does no longer matter whether this energy is deposited by hadrons or whether it is deposited by quarks and gluons, such that theory description and experimental description come more closely to each other. The next issue is that compared to what we knew from electroweak precision physics, the strong coupling constant, which controls the convergence of the QCD perturbative series, is not small. And especially if we compare it to the electromagnetic coupling constant, which controls electroweak processes, and we do this comparison at the Z scale, then we see that the strong coupling constant is, in fact, 15 times larger than the electromagnetic coupling constant, which has two immediate implications. One is that the probability to produced in multi-particle final state compared to electroweak processes is much higher, because for each additional particle which you're adding to your final state, you have to pay a penalty of one order of the coupling constant. Now, if the coupling constant is relatively large, this penalty is not that high, so you will fairly frequently generate multi-particle final states. The other aspect about the largeness of the strong coupling constant is that higher order corrections are more important than they were in the electroweak sector. Important here means really numerically important, that you see a slower convergence of your perturbative series. And this is something which you have to struggle quite a lot in trying to drive QCD to a very precise level. Then the third point is that many observables involve largely different scales, like transverse momenta, gauge boson masses, the top mass. And if you have different scales in a single observable, then you generate logarithms of ratios of these scales, which might spoil the apparent convergence of your perturbative series, and which imply that you might have to reorder your perturbative series, which goes under the name of resummation. So now, having outlined the theoretical challenges, let me go through several different processes which are relevant for colliders, several different QCD standard model processes. I'm not going to cover physics beyond the standard model here in this context. And let me go through the current status and the challenges of each of these observables in some detail. Starting now with heavy quarks, we've already seen yesterday that the total cross sections are fairly well under control. States from the theory side is next to leading order with improved with the next to leading logs of gluon resummation. There are quite a number of next to leading log corrections also available in the literature, and they partly go into these plots as well. What we see is that, first of all, the agreement between data and theory is very good. The soft gluon resummation does not have such a big effect on the cross-section. It yields a slight enhancement. The major effect is that the soft gluon resummation decreases the theoretical uncertainty, because you're somehow grouping together some of the most dominant terms of higher order corrections, and therefore you improve the theoretical upon the theoretical uncertainty. One point in comparing Tevatron and top production at the Tevatron and B-quark production at Hera B is that both of these processes correspond more or less to similar kinematic situations. However, the theoretical uncertainty which you observe at the Tevatron is a lot lower than what you observe at Hera B, which is in part due to the fact that the strong coupling constant at the B mass, relevant for Hera B, is lower than the strong coupling constant, is larger than the strong coupling constant at the T mass, relevant for the top production at the Tevatron. However, this is only part of the story. Another aspect which will then turn back onto you when you go to the LHC is that at the Tevatron, you're largely dominated by quark-antiquark annihilation, and notoriously quark-antiquark annihilation processes have smaller higher order corrections than gluon-gluon scattering processes, which are relevant for the B-quark production at Hera B. So this is something which ought to be kept in mind when you try to scale your experience from the Tevatron to the LHC, that sometimes there are still surprises that higher order corrections could become actually more important at the LHC than they used to be at the Tevatron. Now, this all seems to look very fine for the total cross sections. However, this is only part of the story. This is only two experiments out of quite a number which have measured total cross sections. And the agreement between data and theory is not always that good, especially for BB bar production in gamma proton collisions, say at Hera, or photon-photon collisions at LEP. What you see here is the total BB bar cross section observed at L3 and Opal, and you see that the observed cross section is quite high above what you would expect from theory. However, one thing which ought to be, well, this problem is not understood at present. However, one thing which ought to be kept in mind is that this measurement relies quite heavily on the extrapolation of differential distributions into regions outside the experimental coverage. And this is something which we did not have in the top production at the Tevatron, because there, out of all the tops produced, which are produced at relatively low transverse momentum but decay into very high transverse momentum objects, we see most of them. So we do not need to extrapolate. Likewise, for the B production at Hera B, which is a detector which is deliberately designed to cover a large part of the forward region, we see most of the Bs which are produced. However, in heavy quark production, in especially photon-photon collisions at E plus E minus collider, most of the production cross-section is in the forward region, and we actually do not see what we produce, but we have to correct for everything we do not see. So in turn, it might be a lot better to look, instead of looking into total cross-sections, to look into differential distributions, where you actually compare things you see with a theory which predicts your differential distributions. However, even for differential distributions, there's a long-standing axis in the beam quark transverse momentum distribution observed at a different number of colliders. The measured final state in this case are B hadrons. For example, at the CDF experiment, these are positively, where these data come from, these are positively or negatively charged B hadrons. And this excess has been around with us for a long time, and it motivated a careful reinvestigation of the theory. So the theory, in a nutshell, is as follows, that you are looking at an experimental observable, which is a B-hadron cross-section differential in the transverse momentum, and you get this from your theoretical calculation of a B-quark production cross-section convoluted with pattern distributions for the incoming hadrons, and also convoluted with a fragmentation function for describing the transition from a B-quark into a B-hadron. Now, these pattern distributions have been fairly well understood, have been studied in a wide variety of processes, and have been well established. So the first point to look, and natural point to look, is the fragmentation function. What do we know now about this fragmentation function? The fragmentation functions for heavy hadrons, they're extracted from measurements in E plus E minus annihilation. These measurements are, in this case, meson spectra, which you're measuring. You have a given center of mass energy at your E plus E minus collider, so you very well know your initial state. And what you produce is a BB bar final state fragmenting into your bottom type hadrons. And again, there, since you know your initial state, you also know your four momenta of the B quarks. And just from observing the spectrum of the B hadrons, the energy and momentum spectrum of the B hadrons, you get out information on the B quark to B hadron transition. However, there are many ambiguities which involve the order of your perturbative calculation you compare this to, whether you treat your hard matrix elements in a massless or in a massive way, whether you resum or you do not resum perturbative terms, whether you include and correct for power corrections, whether your data, before you've analyzed them, were already corrected with pattern showers, and last but not least, which is nicely illustrated in this plot, what parametric form you use to fit your function. And what you see here are two different parametric forms. The one which is the dashed curve, which has been more or less the standard for heavy quark fragmentation for almost 20 years, so-called Petersen form. And you see that although this curve is the best fit, it does not describe the data very well, because simply the parametric form which you used as an ansatz for this fit is too stiff to really accommodate the data which go into this process. And it is very much a remnant of this parametric form that you get out this the function in the way it is depicted here, and does not say you too much about the physics. So given that there are so many ambiguities, one important thing to be kept in mind is that the prediction for PP bar, say for the Tevatron, must use the same assumptions as you made in the extraction from the E plus E minus data. Now, one important aspect is the resummation of potentially large logarithms, and it is this resummation which has been performed in the context of the so-called fixed order next to leading log scheme. And if you do this resummation consistently for the E plus E minus and the PP bar, you get a refit of your fragmentation function from the E plus E minus data, which is, as an add-on, done in moment space in order to expose the information content of the E plus E minus data, which are particularly relevant to the PP bar, and to allow a better propagation of the errors on this information. And then you see that the discrepancy, which was quite pronounced in the plot by the CDF collaboration, is already quite a bit lower after doing a consistent treatment of the fragmentation. Now, this is one part of the story. The other part of the story is that there are now new data available which do not confirm the excess initially seen in the round one data. And now we have a good agreement between data and theory. And one thing which one particularly sees on this plot already is that at least the statistical errors on the data, which are the only errors depicted here, are already so small that the error on the theoretical prediction, the error band on the theoretical prediction, is bigger than actually the experimental error. So at some point, if this agreement is finally confirmed in a final analysis of these data, then this observable will be an observable where precision will ultimately be theory limited and no longer experimentally limited. So going back then to B quark production, after having discussed the B hadron production, B quark production as the one depicted from the lab experiments is not measured directly, but B quark distributions are only derived quantities since only the B hadron distributions can be accessed experimentally. And then you infer the B quark distributions using assumptions on the fragmentation. These assumptions should be the same as the ones which were used in the extraction of the fragmentation functions. Resummation is now available for most processes, but still many data sets await reanalysis in a consistent framework. And this might add quite a bit of information and sort out quite a bit of discrepancy between data and theory on the heavy quark production now. Finally, as already was seen in the data from the Tevatron run 2, that higher precision measurements will finally be limited in the comparison data theory by the errors which we make on the theory. And one of the principal sources of errors, especially in the B production, are the unknown higher order corrections. And these unknown higher order corrections are certainly some aspect which ought to be sorted out before the Tevatron, before the LHC would start running, because in order to make meaningful, precise comparisons between data and theory, we will definitely need them. Now, moving on to the next topic, which is jets and multiparticle production. As already outlined in the introduction, jet final states are extremely frequent at colliders. And jet final states are, in their own right, interesting from two points of view. They are, on the one hand, a very sensitive probe of standard model parameters. When you're probing standard model parameters, you're not looking into multi-jet final states, but you look at a small number of jets. For instance, in E plus E minus, at three jet final states, which is the lowest multiplicity jet final state where you see hard gluon radiation. So in order to measure things like the strong coupling constant, you would look at E plus E minus to three jets, electron proton going to 2+1 jets, or a single inclusive jet production at the Tevatron. Another important aspect is the determination of the W and Z masses, and these things you get out from vector boson production or vector boson plus jet production. So for all these observables, you want your QSD prediction to be as precise as possible, because it is in fact the accuracy on the QSD prediction which is limiting the accuracy of your extraction of the standard model parameters, as we will see in a minute. The other aspect of jet final states are multi-jet final states, which are very frequent due to the largeness of the strong coupling constant. And multi-jet final states, as we already heard in Ian's talk, form a very important background for searches. So you want to have a robust QCD prediction as a guidance. You want to have flexible tools to predict any standard model process. So this does mean not only QCD processes, but also QCD and electroweak processes and the interplay. And you want to have flexible tools, because whenever you're confronted with a new model and you want to see whether your new model can be confronted with data, whether you can make meaningful comparison of your model with anticipated data from the LHC, you don't want to sit down for a few months to write a program to compute this observable, but you want to have a tool which you can just take off the shelf and get a standard model prediction which does not need to be a high precision prediction, but which needs to be a solid prediction where you have some control on the error, some control on the normalization of the cross section, in order to design your search strategies, design cuts, and design also in what regions of phase space you actually want to look for your new physics effects. Also, one further important aspect is that, again, here you want to confront this with your experimental efficiency, you want to confront this with the design of your detector, the design of your trigger, and therefore you might want to want QCD also not only to predict you the partonic final state, but also to predict the full hadronic final state. Now, what's the state of the art on all these issues? First of all, state of the art at leading order, which is relevant for multiparticle final states, relevant for searches. This will be covered by Michelangelo's talk later today. And there, at leading order, you have several very efficient codes for multiparticle matrix element generation. And the current limit, Michelangelo may correct me if I'm wrong, is 2 to 8 processes. And the limitation is not so much by the complexity of the program, by the complexity of the problem, but just by CPU time. At some point, you lose interest in these processes if it takes too long to for your computer really to make a meaningful distribution, meaningful predictions for your final states. And there's a large number of codes which do matrix element generation, and matrix elements, of course, only part of the story. You also have to integrate this over multiparticle phase space, and multiparticle phase space becomes increasingly complicated if you increase your number of particles, so you have to design very efficient tools to generate this phase space and to adapt the phase space to a particular kinematic configuration you're looking at. And there are several automatic integrators which are largely based upon the Vegas integration program, optimizing it and adapting it to particular situations. And these two things in combination, the matrix element generation and the phase space, then give you precise give you automatic predictions for cross sections. Now, going on in improvements upon leading order predictions, there now also exists a generic procedure to interface the partonic final state with parton shower. Parton showering is something important, again, accounting for the largeness of the strong coupling constant and the implication that you will, due to the largeness of the strong coupling constant, also have lots of unresolved small angle radiation, which in many observables, like transverse momentum distributions, can make a very big effect by altering the kinematics of your hard process due to multiple soft radiation. And there's now an existing interface, which is a modified matrix element, because you have to subtract some of the terms out of your matrix element, and a vetoed parton shower, such that you discriminate regions between where you find your parton shower more applicable and regions where you find your matrix element more applicable. And this is a generic procedure which can be applied to any process and has been implemented into Monte Carlo programs already. Now, after the parton shower, we are still at the level of a partonic final state. Most of these programs can then be interfaced to hadronization models, since there's a standard interface available, the so-called Lesueux 2001 accord, where Joey can tell you whether this Lesueux 2001 one accord or two accord is one of the two, where simply a standard interface for Monte Carlo authors and authors of hadronization models was specified, such that you can combine your favorite matrix element generator with your favorite hadronization model if both authors were agreed on the standard interface. So finally, with all these things at hand, leading order QCD provides the basis of Monte Carlo event generators. You can generate unweighted events, which you can immediately process through your detector simulation. So these are all advantages of leading order QCD. Coming now to the disadvantages, leading order QCD predictions carry large and especially non-quantifiable theoretical errors from choosing renormalization and factorization scales. Especially as we already saw yesterday, by fiddling around with renormalization and factorization scales, you can alter the normalization of your leading order cross-section in an almost arbitrary manner, because the change of the cross-section with renormalization and factorization scales is monotonous. So as an upshot, leaning order QCD, and I hope Ian will agree with this, leaning order QCD is a very good tool to estimate relative magnitudes of processes and to design searches. As Ian already said, we do not need higher order corrections to make a discovery, to design a search strategy. But once precision is required, which means, for example, to identify a discovery, an anomaly, with a particular model, leading order QCD will suddenly turn out to be no longer sufficient, and we need to move at least to the next to leading order. So state of the art of next to leading order QCD programs, next to leading order, first of all, to summarize what the motivations for next to leading order programs are, it reduces the renormalization scale uncertainty, which in turn implies a lowering of the theoretical error and especially a quantification, a first quantification of the theoretical error. It's also the first order where you get a reliable normalization of your cross-sections. At the leading order, as I said, you can twist the normalization in an almost arbitrary manner, since the change is monotonously here at the next leading order, it's in most cases no longer monotonously, but you get a reliable normalization, you get a reliable error estimate, and you also get first handle on your JET algorithm, because at the next leading order, different JET algorithms will act differently on the partonic final state, because you have more partons than you actually have JETs in your event, so you see differences between different JET algorithms, which are not there at the leading order. At the leading order, each pattern forms a JET on its own, and no matter on what JET algorithm you have, as long as the patterns you produce are sufficiently well separated from each other in phase space, all JET algorithms will give you the same prediction, although they may differ very largely on the application to experimental data. However, in contrary to what you saw at the leading order, where you have many generic programs, there's no generic procedure for next to leading order calculation so far. So results are available for all relevant 2-to-2 processes for quite a while already. The current frontier are 2-to-3 processes, and each of the 2-to-3 processes has been taking several many years. The nature of the calculations is a pattern-level Monte Carlo integrator. It's no longer generated. You do not get unweighted Monte Carlo events out of this, where there are attempts to get unweighted events, but for the moment, most Monte Carlo most NLO programs, which I will be talking about, are Monte Carlo integrators. So first of all, to come to the state of the art of next to leading order 2-to-2 processes, there are programs available for around 10 years. I listed a few of them. Please do not be upset with me if I missed out your favorite program. These are just a few examples for programs which have been used frequently in experimental analysis or simulations. If you compare data and theory, you generally get a good agreement on total rates, but you can't say very much on fully differential cross-sections, which these programs can predict, because fully differential data do become available only now. So it's only in the recent past that people have looked quite more carefully into their round one data to extract more differential JET distributions, like for example here the hadronic thrust distribution obtained by the D0 collaboration and compared to JETRAD. And especially if you look into fully differential data, you will suddenly see that you also enter into regions of phase space where your next to leading order QCD prediction is simply inappropriate, because you're sitting at edges of the phase space where suddenly you start seeing potentially large logarithms which might be resummed. And resummation is something which we know very well from E plus minus annihilation, but which takes a completely different form at hadron colliders, because at hadron colliders you always apply certain cuts to isolate your final state from the experiment, and most of the resummation tools we know from E plus minus colliders will not apply to purely jet-like observables at hadron colliders, and you might turn to more subtle resummation tools, especially to purely numerical resummations, and there's been quite some progress on this in the recent past in applying resummation tools to hadron colliders. So going on to 2-to-3 processes, there's a number of processes which have been computed in the recent past, and I just plotted here one example of the PP going to 3-jet cross-section, which simply illustrates you some of the improvements you get by going from leading order to next to leading order, especially your dependence on the renormalization scale plotted here on the x-axis, is reduced considerably, and you see this fairly large plateau, which is symptomatic for next to leading order predictions, and which allows you to quantify the theoretical error on this prediction. So going on beyond this frontier, of course, one thing which we have seen at Leading Order, if you start designing searches or start analyzing discoveries, you want to have an automatic program which can predict you a large number of different final states. And automatic programs that next to Leading Order, as I already mentioned, are not available yet, and there's especially one big showstopper for these programs for the moment. And this showstopper we can identify if you look into the ingredients to a next to Leading Order calculation for an n-parton final state. There you need the virtual one-loop matrix element with n partons, the real matrix element with n plus one partons, and a procedure to extract the infrared singularities from both of these, because both of them have infrared singularities due to soft and collinear emission, and to combine them. If you combine them, it gives you a result which, after ultraviolet renormalization of your virtual matrix elements, is finite and can be evaluated numerically for a certain event definition, for a certain jet algorithm, or for a certain event shape observables. The last two points, the treatment of real n plus one parton matrix elements and a procedure to extract infrared singularities from the real matrix elements, were solved for arbitrary n quite some time ago, about 15 years ago, in the context of the 2-to-2 calculations. And the methods go under phase-based slicing, subtraction, and dipole formalism, which is an improvement upon the subtraction method. Now, the first point, there's no generic procedure available for the automatic computation of one-loop integrals. So this is something which is, for the moment, the big showstopper to automatic next to Leading Order calculations. And there are many ideas how one could automatize next to Leading Order, either by finding a subtraction formalism for virtual corrections, so very much in the style as you handle your real corrections now, by not evaluating your n plus one parton matrix elements, but by identifying the terms in the matrix element which give rise to certain subsingularities. You would like to apply the same thing also to virtual one-loop matrix elements. Going more specifically to 2-to-4 processes, what you need there are hexagon integrals, and there's been quite some progress on the analytic reduction and the numerical evaluation of hexagon amplitudes. Also going in the same style of subtraction formalism is the soft collinear separation procedure, which has been put forward to isolate infrared singularities from loop amplitudes. And as final point, there's been recently put forward a infrared rearrangement which avoids all these things of talking about virtual corrections and real corrections all the way through, and which might be the way to automatize these corrections. Now, let me be very brief on this aspect of interfacing next to Leading Order calculations with parton showers, since Stefano will give an entire talk on this. The idea behind it is that you modify the next to Leading Order subtraction method in order to get your hard radiation from the NLO matrix element and your soft radiation from a parton shower in such a way that you avoid double counting but still recover the correct normalization for the total rates. What you see here are the virtues of this correction, that at large transverse momenta you're dominated by hard radiation, at low transverse momenta your prediction is dominated by soft radiation, and you get a prediction which is applicable over the whole range of phase space, combining the advantage of parton showers with the advantages of next to Leading Order calculations. Now, going beyond the next to Leading Order, you find that next to Leading Order is very often not sufficient to make precise comparisons between data and theory, and one of the prime examples for this is the measurement of the strong coupling constant from the single jet inclusive cross section, where one of the largest errors, besides the experimental systematic error, which might or might not improve, according to yesterday's speakers, the hope is that people get, with running their detectors for a longer time, better understanding of things like jet energy scale setting, so that the systematic error can be improved. But one thing which even with an ideal experiment you cannot improve upon is the scale error inherent to the next to Leading Order theory prediction. And this is a dominant source of uncertainty on the extraction of standard model parameters from jet data. Now, one might argue that this is some particular feature unique to EP collisions, but if you look at E plus E minus collisions, then for three jet type observables at LEP or 2+1 jet observables in deep elastic scattering at HERA, you again see that the scale uncertainty for LEP is certainly the dominant error, and for the 2+1 jet observables at HERA, is one of the dominant errors and clearly the largest error. So to conclude upon this, the next leading error scale uncertainty dominates the error on the extraction of the sun coupling constant from colliders. There are quite a number of more reasons to go beyond the next leading error. It's a better matching of the partner level jet algorithm and the Hadron level jet algorithm, since now you're modeling your jet not only with two partons like at next leading order, but with three partons, so you're more sensitive on subtle differences between jet algorithms. Also, you get a better description of transverse momentum recoil of final states, since you allow for double radiation in the initial state. You get a modification to your power corrections, where at present it is not clear whether this modification reduces the power corrections or enhances them. One will only find out if one goes really to a next-to-next leading error calculation. And one thing which already has been emphasized yesterday and will certainly be emphasized again this afternoon is that in order to get a next-to-next leading order extraction of partner distributions, which in turn turns into a lower error on benchmark process at the LHC and the Tevatron, you also need next-to-next leading order calculations of the observables going into your FIT. Now, ingredients to your next-to-next leading order NJET calculation, again, there will be a dedicated talk on this during this workshop, are two-loop matrix elements, one-loop matrix elements, tree-level matrix elements, and beyond that, in the one-loop matrix element, since you look into n plus one partner final states, you have to find a procedure to extract the singularities which you get from radiating this additional partner softly or collinearly. And there are generic formalisms known to extract these singularities and to integrate them out over the one particle subphase space in the full final state phase space. Now, for the tree-level matrix elements, you need, on the one hand, subtraction terms which subtract you out singularities from single particle emission, which is something, some problem which was already solved at the next to leading order a long time ago. However, what you also need to account for are configurations where you simultaneously emit two particles in an unresolved manner, and these things are to still remain to be calculated, although there has been quite a bit of progress in the recent past on this, as I will elaborate in a few minutes. So concerning, first of all, the two-loop matrix elements, they have seen really an enormous progress in the past years. The challenge you're facing in calculating two-loop scattering amplitudes is that you have to deal typically with tens of thousands of integrals, which, however, you can reduce to a very small number of so-called master integrals using integration by parts identities, which rely on the fact that any surface terms in dimensional regularization, which you use to regulate these integrals, are vanishing and therefore yield you relations between different integrals. If you look at multi-particle scattering amplitudes, then scattering amplitude is a scalar. However, it depends on a number of external momenta, and on these external momenta, you can perform Lorentz transformations of special relativity without changing the amplitude itself. And this Lorentz invariance of the amplitude gives you more relations between the integrals and allows you to reduce them to a small number of so-called master integrals. Then these master integrals, still you have to compute them, but there have been some quite innovative techniques been invented in the recent past, which allowed for all 2-to-2 scattering posts, these master integrals to be computed. So this, in turn, yielded us a large list of posts for which we have the 2-to-2 matrix elements. First was the Baba scattering for massless electrons, all the subprose going into two jet production at hadron colliders, all the posts going into photon pair production at the LHC, and more recently the three jet production processes at E plus E minus and their crossings. What's ongoing for the moment are matrix elements with internal masses. Internal masses pose an additional difficulty, since you have one more scale in your problem, and one more scale means simply a more complex analyticity structure and a larger basis of basis functions, which in turn means that the whole algebra which goes in there is a lot more involved than it was in the masterless case. Now, turning away from the double virtual to the double real radiation, keeping in mind that the single real radiation of one-loop matrix elements is a solved problem, the double real radiation is easily illustrated at this example, where you have a five-parton configuration degenerating into a three-jet final state. And you get this degeneracy by integrating two of these partons over the oriented two-parton final state phase space of, say, two of these gluons. And these two gluons can come into different configurations, all containing singularities. There's triple collinear configuration, double single collinear configuration, soft collinear, double soft configurations. The issue at stake is now to find subtraction functions which approximate these full matrix elements in all singular limits, but are still sufficiently simple to be integrated analytically. In the recent past, these things were encountered in a number of particular calculations, and in each of these calculations, people have invented methods to deal with these problems, but no generic method has emerged for the treatment of these issues so far. So the generic method, people are still looking for it, and in the recent past, there has been progress towards such a generic method. One was, first of all, the smooth mapping of the n plus 2 parton final state phase space into the n parton phase space times a double unresolved phase space factor, which is by itself proportional to a four-particle phase space, since we have here a two-particle subphase space which is oriented with the rest with respect to the remaining partons. So we get a in total a four-particle phase space which we have to integrate out. There has been a proposal for unified subtraction terms, and there have been inclusive four-particle phase space integrals for all the QSD matrix elements which you can imagine at the next to leading order. And again, you can reduce them to master integrals and compute them analytically, or you can compute them purely numerically with a new tool, the so-called iterated sector decomposition. So available at present are subtraction terms, which are in a form which could not be integrated up to now, and a class of integrals which are not yet matching the structure of subtraction terms. And one of the major issues also during the next leading order session of this workshop is to make a relation between the existing subtraction terms and the existing integrals, or to find better subtraction terms, or to find better integration methods. Also, well, it has to be kept in mind that the iterated sector decomposition is a promising purely numerical method which might overcome quite a number of the limitations of the analytic calculations. So just to briefly flash, people are already thinking at beyond next to leading order physics, jet physics, and at least the calculational structure of all the ingredients to n cube leading order jet physics have been explored in several works in the literature. Now, moving away from jets to photons, photons are inherently complicated because you have two different production processes for photons. One is the direct process, where you simply have a hard photon radiating off a parton, but what you can also have is a parton fragmenting into a highly energetic photon. Well, the parton does not exactly fragment into a photon, but it fragments into a jet, which might, however, contain a photon carrying most of the jet energy. Now, the problem is that at higher orders in perturbation theory, both of these processes cannot no longer be separated from each other, but are inherently tied to each other. So photons are never fully isolated from final state hadrons. And you have to define isolation procedures, which are not exact isolation, but sort of minimal requirements for a photon to be called isolated. And the procedures are either an isolation cone, which is used more frequently, that you only allow a minimum amount of hadronic energy in a cone around your photon, or an alternative method is the so-called democratic clustering, where you cluster, first of all, your event like a normal jet event, and the photon ends up in one of the jets, and then you check whether the photon energy exceeds some threshold fraction of the jet energy, and then you call this jet a photon jet. Both isolation criteria are infrared safe, but both isolation criteria also induce contribution from the non-perturbative Poincaré true photon fragmentation function. There have been improvements on this isolation cone procedure to reduce the dependence on the fragmentation function, but after all, it will not go fully away. One thing to be kept in mind about the cone-based isolation is that you can't make the cones too small, because otherwise your perturbative series breaks down, which is reflected in the fact that your isolated photon cross-section suddenly gets bigger than the inclusive cross-section, where in the experimental sample, the isolated cross-section is always a subsample of the inclusive cross-section. So why are photons so interesting? We already heard this quite a few times during this workshop. Photons are a background, photon pairs are a background to the Higgs search in the Higgs to two photons decay mode. So there you have a number of subprocesses, which at least at the LHC are all of comparable magnitude, since you have many more gluons in your collisions than you have quarks and antiquarks. So even the gluon-gluon scattering process, although down by two orders in the strong coupling constant contributes similar to the quark-antiquark annihilation process. For all these processes, the NLO calculations are now complete, and it's the first example that really these two loop amplitudes, in this case two gluons going into two photons, were used in an actual calculation. And the cross-section, as can be seen from this plot, where the diphoton cross-section is depicted for different photon isolation criteria, depends on the photon isolation and is sensitive to the photon fragmentation function, which only can be got out of lab data. And people might want to have another look at lab data, whether we can get better information on the photon fragmentation function out of the data we have. Given that in particular only two out of four lab experiments have analyzed their data in view of getting out the photon fragmentation function. Next to leading order as final point is also available for the photon pair plus jet, which is an interesting process if, for instance, you were to veto on a jet, or whether you were to look for Higgs produced through gauge boson fusion. Now, already having talked about backgrounds to gauge and Higgs production, let's talk also about the production processes. There will be another talk in this workshop, especially dedicated to these observables. Well, first of all, to summarize the theory states for the inclusive processes, we have the next-to-next to leading order corrections. For the Grelian process, they're available already for quite a while. For the Higgs production, they became available only in the recent past. The Higgs production especially exploited new tools, which were, on the one hand, the expansion around the soft limit, that you look at this production process in the soft limit, and then you expand to higher and higher terms, sufficiently high that you finally can reconstruct the full coefficient function from this. Another aspect to this was the extension of multi-loop techniques like integration by parts and Lorentz invariants, or also differential equations, to phase-based integrals. And it is the same, it are the same techniques which now start proving valuable in the double unresolved subtraction terms for jet physics. And this is the first place that the gauge boson production processes were the first place that these multi-loop techniques were transferred onto phase space integrals. Now, recent NLO results for inclusive Higgs boson production include standard model Higgs production from gluon fusion, also including next-to-next to leading logarithmics of gluon resummations, pseudo-scalar Higgs production, which is, as far as the Feynman diagrams are concerned, very similar to the standard model boson Higgs production, also Higgs from bottom quark fusion, which in particular has sorted out a year-long discussion about whether to use or not to use B densities to describe this process, and it has been sorted out in a way that strongly supports the B density approach. Finally, the Higgs Strahlung process, which is very similar to the Dreyer process, has also been computed to next to leading order. Now, next to leading order for inclusive cross sections is not the full story. Mainly, you want more differential distributions like the rapidity distribution, especially given that experiments only cover a limited range in rapidity. For the Higgs boson, the rapidity distribution has recently been computed to next to leading order, showing that it is relatively stable under higher order corrections. Even more important is the transverse momentum distribution, and at fixed order, you have to keep in mind that your fixed order results are reliable only for transverse momenta of the order of the gauge boson mass you're considering or above it. And if you go with your transverse momenta well below your boson mass, then you require soft gluon resummation. And there's a dedicated talk at this workshop such that I will not elaborate any further on this. Now, as far as the inclusive cross-sections are concerned for the vector boson production, turning now from the Higgs to vector bosons, they can be measured extremely precisely, they are theoretically well understood, and the relevant partons are well constrained. And we've already heard quite a few times that these reactions may serve as a benchmark reaction for the LHC to monitor on a day-by-day basis the luminosity of your machine. However, one has to keep in mind that, again, the experimental coverage for these things is limited, and what you actually will be using as a benchmark reaction is the rapidity distribution and not the inclusive cross-section. this rapidity distribution has been computed very recently, less than a month ago, to the next-to-next leading order with another extension of multi-loop tools. What's shown here is a plot, not for LHC or Tevatron, but for fixed-target experiments, outlining an important aspect, which I'm sure James will come back to this afternoon, that parton distributions, which were fitted at the next to leading order to the data depicted here, they might undergo change by going from next to leading order to next to next to leading order. And a substantial change even beyond the uncertainty which you currently quote on your coefficient functions. Now, as a very last point, let me briefly turn to parton distributions, although there will be two talks this afternoon about them. Parton distributions are obtained from a global fit, which means that you analyze data from different observables to determine all partonic distribution functions. And there are two sources of errors coming in. One is the error propagation from the data to distributions. Your data are not perfect. You have errors on your data, and the errors on your data propagate into errors on your parton distributions. However, one other source of errors which ought not to be underestimated is the next to leading order theory error, which is already now comparable to the data errors. So to improve upon this, you need the partonic cross sections to next to leading order, and you have them for fully inclusive processes, but you do not have them for things like jet production or direct photon production. This is still not the whole story. What you also need are splitting kernels to next to leading order, and the calculation of them is very well advanced, and Sven will report on the latest results on them. So let me then conclude my overview on the status of QCD for colliders. Well, first of all, QCD is present in every single process you will be looking at, the Tevatron or the LHC, because you're always starting with a strongly interacting initial state. And even if you have a purely weakly interacting final state, you have to deal with QCD as far as the description of your initial state is concerned. It might modify the recoil of your final state. It might modify certain properties of your final state. So you do have to worry about QCD. QCD is now becoming precision physics. Leading order is a very valuable tool to estimate and to design search strategies. You have many generic tools, and you can even interface to parton showers and hadronization. Next to leading order is important to refine the searches and to identify signals with models. Current frontier are 2 to 3 processes. 2 to 4 will require new tools, because we won't go ahead and do any imaginable 2 to 4 process individually. There's also an interface to parton showers, and so you can get next to leading order event generation. Next to leading order is mandatory for precision physics and for benchmark processes. The current frontier is 2 to 1, single inclusive production. 2 to 2 is well underway. Resummation effects are often important, and as a last and non-negligible point, is that many predictions require input from lab data, such as fragmentation functions for heavy quarks or photons, and we might want to get the lab data. We might want to keep the lab data in a safe state, such that if, after turning on the LHC, there are suddenly new problems emerging, we might be able to go back to the lab data and extract new information, which might become important for interpretation of LHC and Tevatron signals. Thanks a lot.
Questions?
So in the project of improving the leading order Monte Carlo that you describe, I think that there is a suggested that there is a missing point, which is the branching. The branching of the status of the art of the branching now has been established 15 years ago when Ehrlich started. But I think that now we know a lot of things about branching. Yeah. And we can probably working hard include at least a single log contribution coming from instance from larger angles of emission, which is not included yet and need to be included. But there are other challenging things which can be worked out, I think, maybe, which are related to the fact that you have a 1/NC square correction. You have a 1/NC limit going to zero limit in the present Monte Carlo, taking into account at least the first correction is probably a doable thing. And another challenging thing can be the Coulomb phase, which is a single log correction present in the hadronic collision, which maybe we need it. Yep. So Monte Carlo needs to be corrected, and next to leading correction are there, next to leading order calculation are there, and they will help us. But I think we have to work also the branching.
No, I entirely
so
agree
this
with, yeah.
could be a project for the next few months workshop.
Well, I entirely agree with you. One thing which I tried to point out in the context of discussing leading order Monte Carlo programs was the currently achieved modular structure of these things, that matrix element generation, phase-based generation, partonic showering, and hadronization are all different modules linked to each other with, in principle, standard interfaces. So whenever somebody comes up with a better idea and a better description of partonic showering, even present-day Monte Carlos can, if they comply with the standard interfacing structure, be rather easily adapted to these, and these new ideas can be rather easily tested out on these programs.
I have more of a comment. As an experimentalist, it might be somehow difficult or maybe time-consuming to always keep track or keep up to date what is the status for all kind of processes, the calculations and so on. So would it be a proposal or kind of a goal, for example, to come up with a very well maintained database, something like a website with the full list of processes, the status of the calculation, which order implemented or not in a Monte Carlo reference and so on? Does it exist already? I don't know. I think it could be nice, I don't know.
Not to my understanding. I mean, I know that certain authors keep web pages for their programs. I mean, the most prominent, John might correct me on this, is the MCFM, which at the next to leading order includes a large number of processes. And the aim of the MCFM project is certainly to have a one-stop website where you can go and download the next to leading order program relevant to the process you're considering. However, this is complete for the process included in MCFM, and if you look at beyond the standard model process, where you also have next to leading order programs available, it's a different website. What one might envisage is within the space of Atlas and CMS to have these websites, because there you could immediately also link them to people who have experience in applying these programs to actual physical situations. So it is certain, it might also be a goal for this workshop just to set up such type of a website as a service to the community.
Question, Michael?
Maybe this question is best addressed to another speaker, but it was raised by the answer to the previous question. It's not so simple to interface a parton shower to hadronization. I mean, you can define a convention for it, but a parton shower algorithm is correct to leading log or to a certain order, but the actual implementation of it, if it's different, introduces things that basically have the order of power corrections. And then the hadronization also, of course, is completely phenomenological and might be done differently by different programs.
Yeah.
So ultimately, I think you have to refit a large fragmentation data sample, an E plus E minus data sample, let's say, to the product of any parton shower cross hadronization. It would really be nice if there were a way around this, but I have no idea what it is. And maybe that's a topic that ought to be discussed at this workshop.
Yep.
Okay, other questions? Keeping in mind that you're standing between us and the break.
No, it's just a very small clarification. That as far as the method of sector decomposition for extracting the infrared divergences from real radiation graphs, we have applied it not only inclusively but also at the exclusive level,
yep,
implementing Z definitions and everything else needed for realistic processes.
Yeah, this is why I pointed this out as a very promising numerical method, which gets you well beyond only inclusive. Yeah.
I'm sorry, it's really like this, but we have tested it on a simplest example.
Yes.
Okay, now, your question, what is the simplest example? I don't know. But it's a comprehensive.
Yeah.
It's not there. Something has to be edited.
Well, it has to be applied to a non-trivial example.
Well, all the methods you were talking about, I'm not going to apply to a single example.
Yeah.
That's a big
question. I'm not sure this is a well-defined question, but I ask anyway. Is there any clear strategy how to assess the uncertainties about next linear calculation once you're using that calculation for the data to...
Well, there's sort of a convention that you start varying your factorization and normalization scales within a range which is between half the central value and twice the central value. Whether this gives you an estimate, gives you a correct estimate of the theoretical error or not, might be debatable. Experience shows that for processes where at some point you only had the next to leading order available and then next to leading order calculations became available, that in most of the cases, the next to leading order result fell into this error band which you specified by this method. However, it has to be kept in mind that this method is still in some sense ad hoc, since if you look at the plots where, about the variation of your cross sections with the scales, then although they show a turning point somewhere, they're still, if you go out to very large values or very small values of your scales, they still go well beyond the band which you specified by your half and twice criterion.
Is that the answer you're looking for, Wiming?
Well, it's not really an answer.
I was looking for is there any other way from the data point of view can set the limits, you know. When you do something, you have a data, certainly we can check that. But if there's not to have a data, it's a particular case, is there other ways you can give a handle to set some limits using the data itself instead wave hands to say that, okay, go half your range?
To my understanding, there's no.
It's okay, we can talk more about it.
Okay, any other questions? If not, let's thank our speaker again.